Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
Now, Pat Egan, how are you, Pat?
Dave, great to be here.
Good, well, it's good to have you here. Pat Egan, by the way, has written a book here. It's just the stories, but no, the whole, the overall picture as much as anything else, because it's a good, like a lot of it's 10 years before I was even, or could anybody be around. So that's the basis of so much that I finally became part of. We're talking here about A Life in Show Business, which I think is almost an ironic title. It's A Life in Music, really, you know, in many ways.
Well, it's a combination, I suppose.
By the way, the book is called Backstage Pass. It's by Pat Egan, and it is fantastic. So let's take a look at bits and pieces of this book. I don't even know where to start. Will I start with the anecdotes or will I just start with the book itself? Like, you were 50 years some of the best known names in showbiz, and this is a behind the scenes look at the whole lot of them. Let's take two of the things you did. One of them was you were the first major promoter for gigs in Ireland that meant anything at all, right?
Well, I don't think Peter Aiken or Jim Aiken, his dad, would probably agree with that. Jim was really the pioneering promoter in Ireland. He was the first guy. Once they stopped running gigs in the Adelphi Cinema and the Theatre Royal, Jim took over as the main man in promoting and brought in a lot of the early
acts.
Okay,
well then let's take the word arena and let's take the word kind of outdoor in a football field. Okay, you did Bob Marley and you did Queen.
Well, yeah, the Bob Marley one was the first, it wasn't the first outdoor, there was a Thin Lizzy before that in Dalymount, but it was the first one with a big, big name.
Yeah.
And at the time, I mean, I had no idea that it would, I mean, it's become a bit of a kind of a legendary kind of gig in terms of the fact that he's a big mural of him in Dalymount Park and they hang on, they have a little museum up there and it's not all football, a good piece of it is Bob Marley.
Yeah.
So it was, at the time I had no idea, as I said, I just went with the flow with the gigs, things, and there'd been no kind of previous record or template of gigs. So you went in and you kind of flew by the seat of your pants. There was no license needed. There was no health and safety issues. There was nothing whatsoever.
Yeah. And because you had Dave Fanning as a stage announcer on that. That was pretty cool. I'll tell you also, I know somebody wanted to make a documentary about it recently to celebrate 50 years, whatever. And there isn't one piece of film of anything. It wasn't even a thing with anybody in terms of the media, you know.
No, there were some good photographs. Yeah. And Garrick Luke took pictures for the Times, which were very good. So, I mean, from that point of view, I went into the police station in Mountjoy Police Station probably 10 days before the gig to tell them there that we'd have a crowd. And I can remember to this day the big sergeant coming out with a big book and making a note in the book and saying, how many are you expecting? And I said, well, I'm hoping for 20,000 or more. And he said, oh my God, that many or whatever. And just as I was leaving, he said to me, would there be a few tickets for the lads? So that was the kind of preparation that the gig had.
Yeah.
Unlike now, if you run a gig outdoors now, the amount of paperwork and attention to detail is ginormous.
I know, but two names you mentioned there. One was Jim Aiken, who you have massive respect for, but at the same time, when it needed to be ruthless in business, you lost in some ways. He undercut you, to say the least. When was it, for the second time for Queen or something? Oh, yeah. I know what it was. You were going to get Queen again, according to the book. That's, but he said he didn't tell you he was putting Queen on
Jim had a reputation, Gentleman Jim, which everybody liked.
Yeah,
he was a really
great.
You could talk to Jim, anyone could talk to him. He had a great way with people. But when it came to business, obviously, and especially in the rock and roll business, you had to have some kind of a ruthless streak, which unfortunately I never had. But Jim certainly had one. And I had done the Queen gig in the Simmons Court, which was the very first gig there in 1979. And then they wanted to come back again. And I had gone to London to see Harvey Goldsmith. And he had more or less said, OK, if you get slain, you can have the gig. And I had approached Henry Mountcharles, who said, if you have Queen, you can have Slane. So, but at the in between time, Jim had got in with the management of Queen, and when I went to the RDS to check out availabilities there and things like that, Jim told me that you're out of the picture,
yeah,
boy.
Yeah, right. Yeah, in fact, a few people told you in the book that kind of thing, and you were almost happy to go to the side because you thought the really big, huge sort of Las Vegas approach to music, the way it became, would have been too much for you. You just weren't really into all that stuff.
Well, I probably didn't have the know-how, or I certainly didn't have that kind of killer business instinct that was needed, where, you know, you could tell people to feck off or whatever it was. I didn't. I didn't have that. I liked a softly, softly approach. I liked to get on with people, and I liked everybody to share if there was a money to be made, that everybody should share. That has gone out the window now in the entertainment business.
Okay, another person you mentioned back there was Phil Lynott, and you knew Phil very, very well, but you never really knew him as a rock star.
No, I met him way back when he was in a band called the Black Eagles, and he used to come over to near where I lived in Dorset Street to Synod Place, where there was a lot of kind of band stuff going on. Bruce Shields was the main man around that area, Pat Quigley from the Movement and things. But Phil was more of a mate. You know, we'd go out in different clubs together. We'd go into town to the Coffee Inn and that kind of stuff. Myself, John Hodges, Phil and Mick O'Brien, Tony Bradfield. That was the kind of group we had. But Phil, at that stage, I did introduce Phil to Rory Gallagher, actually. There's a picture going around of myself in the centre and Rory Gallagher.
There's a great picture in the book, yeah.
Yeah, and that was the night after Taste had played the Scene Club.
Right.
And I was doing an interview with Rory up at the Five, and Philo said, "Can I come along?" And I said, "Of course."
Philo came along because he wanted to meet Rory.
That's right.
According to the book, yeah.
So... that was actually when Rory's guitar was stolen that particular day as well. That's what happened. So with Phil, I started to develop the record shops and stuff, and Phil went from, of course, into Skid Row, into Thin Lizzy and the rest.
Yeah, and you mentioned Thin Lizzy, like 73 or so on Top of the Pops, and like, wow, isn't it fantastic? There, look, an Irish band, isn't it so cool? Because that was the pinnacle of everything kind of thing. But the song, seriously, I mean, I think you're the same as me, like, seriously, Whiskey in the Jar,
yes,
lads?
Yes, it didn't make a lot of sense, even though it was a rock and roll version of it, but it worked, and it got them the attention they needed.
But the thing is also that you mentioned, we might as well mention the triumvirate then, because Phil Lynott was a really, really nice guy and a very good guy.
And he was.
Now, I always thought that Rory was just too gentle for this world. He was one of the I hated always interviewing him because he just wanted to pick up the guitar and play. He was just such a nice, quiet guy.
He was
such
was.
But the third one, is Van Morrison.
Well,
now, let's take a few Van stories there now, Pat.
Well, I went, when I was writing for Spotlight, I was an enormous fan of Van Morrison because I had been out in the Stella in Mount Marion and I'd seen them playing just after Baby Please Don't Go had made the chart. Mm. And then Here Comes the Night was an absolute eye-opener at the time.
Brilliant.
And I loved Van and I wrote about him all the time. And after them, of course, broke up, he went to America and he recorded with Burt Burns for Bang Records.
And the rest
whatever.
Is the first 10 albums that are history and just 10 of the best ever made. Yeah.
And so Van would send me, he sent me a parcel of album, including the album and two copies of Brown Eyed Girl, which were the first copies, I think, to come this side of the world. And I would play them in the Five Club all the time. But then when I actually met him, I was doing a tour at the time, and one of his first tours, in fact, in Ireland. But before that, in Spotlight, I'd got a call one day and he invited me out to... I thought it was Sam Smith and Donald Corvin playing a joke on me at the time, but it was Van invited me out to
Navan.
Exactly, a country house in Navan where he was staying, invited me out for dinner. So I arrived out full of joy and expectation and for a long chat or whatever. I was brought into the sitting room or whatever. The lady, the housekeeper said, "Mr. Morrison will be with you shortly," or whatever it was. About half an hour later, she returned and she said to me, "Mr. Morrison's decided he's not having dinner tonight."
Yeah.
So I basically had to feck off out of the place or whatever. And
Okay, but that's not the only time. You also drove back from Cork with Van.
I did.
The car.
That was the tour.
That's 165 miles or whatever.
That was the tour. The
3 hours
tour.
At least
and
on the roads.
It is no lie to say that he, as he got into the car, he grunted at me and for the whole journey, never said one simple word. And then when we got to the Shelburne, he kind of grunted at me again and went into it.
Right.
And but that didn't bother me.
No, in the book you say, like, that's Van, you know, like, people are what they are. But seriously, you know, like, anybody can read into all that what they want, you know.
Yeah.
He's kind of ranting a bit at the moment, isn't he, giving out about vaccine?
Well, he is, I think he went from being so kind of reclusive in the early days. He was, you know, nobody could get near him or whatever.
Michelle took him out of his shell. Yeah, he was around.
Pretty much so.
Yeah, I remember with a band once going to town after the program, and they came, an American band, and they just sat there. They just could not believe that they were looking at Van Morrison dancing on a dance floor. They were just like, "What is? Who was the band? Was it? I think it was Buffalo Tom or
Well, if you look at the early Brown Eyed Girl TV stuff from America too, he's kind of he's appearing on TV shows, and he's he is starting moving a bit, you know. But
yeah, can I just ask you there about that? You say you have Brown Eyed Girl, maybe the first copy kind of whatever. I think is Brown Eyed Girl the second most played song in the history of American radio after Louie Louie or something? In which case, you're sitting on a fortune.
Top five, all right. It's huge. Yeah.
Are you sitting on a fortune? When you say you played them in the Five Club, they're still in good condition, are they?
Well, they're singles. I would have played them 50, 60, 100 times or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But it was, I got a letter from his mum as well at the time thanking me for the writing about him in Spotlight and keeping his name up there, you know.
Yeah, indeed. Right. Okay. So, I mean, like, there's so much, there's an awful lot of stuff towards the end of the book where you are very angry. And one of the things you're angry about is the place you're in right now, which would be something like 2FM or the National Concert Hall or whatever. We'll just take 2FM, first of all, which is just a microcosm of all the pop music stations, saying, why the hell do Irish bands have to suffer so much? Why does anybody have to make it abroad and not make it here? In other words, would it be, as I was saying on the radio just last week, would it be a good idea if there was a law that said 30% of everything played on Irish pop music radio should be Irish?
Of course there would.
And I'm not talking Westlife or U2 here.
Yeah, no, of course it would. It's just, it. You see, if you don't fit into a certain niche as a young Irish musician, your avenues are totally blocked. There's nowhere to get your music heard. And I know a lot of the stuff that was made, certainly in the 60s and 70s, a lot of the Irish stuff wasn't up to standard and probably not good enough for radio. But that's all changed. And, I made a point there about Donna Taggart, who's an extremely talented songwriter, guitar player, getting 220 million hits on her song, Jealous of the Angels. And I... You know, I had to get it down on one knee to Ronan Collins here and he's been a friend all my life, to get him to play it once, and nobody else wanted to know. Yet the whole world was aware of the song, and it was a hugely emotive song as well. But I just feel that 2FM should become an Irish station. I know this has been said before, and play the very best of Irish, whether it's gold.
But do you
Irish.
Not think that every single pop music, I mean, like, you know, nobody who owns the pop music stations owns the pop music stations. They belong to the Irish people, the airwaves. So, like, they're the custodians of it. Do you not think if there was a law, everything would
yes,
be
yes, there should be a law. And it's
like, been, there is in Canada and France.
I mean, I think Hot Press were on the trail of that quite a few years ago. Niall Stokes did a lot of work, and I know there is no legislation out there that couldn't be corrected to give Irish music a 30% percentage airplay.
Do you know, just to go to the clubs there now, like, that you were involved in down through the years, you know, like, you really do have to kind of look at the stuff and go, what? Like, before the Kinahans, there was the Dunn Brothers and all that, very famous and very well known. Like, you have stories of bringing the money from the waterfront and going up at 3 a.m. to stick it in a bank somewhere in Camden Street or something, and this guy comes around, rams your car, and, you know, you have to hand over the bag of a few grand cash, and your man, your friend, was thinking he might do a bit of a Stephen Seagal, as you put it in the book.
Exactly. Well, in the 80s, Dublin was a very, very wild kind of town. I mean, there were bank robberies on a weekly basis, nearly. And the Gardaí, or the state, hadn't brought in any laws to protect people properly. So the gangster thing was only in its infancy, I suppose, but they were everywhere in terms of nightlife and anything that attracted them, where there was money and whatever. So the waterfront was one of the few late night clubs in those days, because it was one of the few late night places where you could get alcohol.
Yeah, the waterfront was the place that became famous for two things from my point of view, which was The Commitments.
Yeah.
It was filmed there and all the rest, and they had the big night there after the major movie thing. And also David Bowie played there with Tin Machine.
After the Bag It In, night after the Bag It In,
So...
So the waterfront, it was a strange kind of place. It wasn't the money. It made some money, but I got it as part of a deal that I'd done with Jerry O'Reilly, who owned the Bad Bob's pub. Jerry was the previous owner of the waterfront. And we had done a deal, and complicated, so he offered me the waterfront as part payment for it or whatever. That's how I ended up there. I didn't want to be in a nightclub. And especially, you don't want to be in a nightclub when it's dangerous. And Dublin at that period, as I said, was extremely dangerous.
Okay, there's so many things that you can talk about in terms of the music, but there's one I want to mention in terms of just what you do as a promoter and music as well. And that is one of the things that's wrong with the country in some ways. And that is that, like, you know, if there's, you've been on many stations years ago talking about this on television and all the rest, which is, if the National Concert Hall can be closed for 101 nights a year, is it that people think it's just highfalutin stuff of Beethoven and all the rest? And, like, why not let a promoter like you come in with those over 50s things, bring in, if you like, more working class people? Which was a simple thing that you were doing a little bit of, and then you were shunted out because they didn't want it.
Yeah, it was just, they changed the music policy in the concert hall. They wanted a more diverse and more international flavour, new world music and all that kind of stuff or whatever. And what I was doing was very middle of the road. But when I started out in the concert hall, Judith Woodward was the lady who was running it. And she had said to me a lot of times, she said, Pat, you know, we need the highbrow stuff, obviously, because that's our bread and butter as such. But the cream comes from the kind of shows that you bring in, because it's bringing in people who, they had been trying for a long time to get a wider audience into the concert hall. We managed to achieve that, doing enormous business, like 95% capacity all the time. And then it was seen as a bit not trendy and a bit square. So they wanted to bring in a new ideas or whatever.
Okay, just a few things left. I mentioned Van Morrison earlier. What about Eric Clapton? I mean, he's one of the closest to you in some ways. Every single time he's ever been here, it was you who brought
him. Well, except for the very last time, he changed management, and I did five tours, I think, with him altogether. And it was a great... I wasn't close with him in the sense that he knew who I was and he talked to me a bit or whatever, but a lot of the early days he was going through one of his darker periods. But I built up a good relationship with the manager or whatever, and Eric was, you know, coming to Ireland five or six times, playing small venues around the country was, you know, was a terrific thing in those days, because he was such a big star. But unlike my relationship with Billy Connolly, I wouldn't have been close to Eric in the same way. Billy was different. He was a different kettle of fish altogether.
There's so many names in the book that I can mention. I'm just going to mention one here. God, does he come across badly. Mickey Rooney, the very famous Hollywood actor. He was a real idiot, was he?
Well, he was 80 when he came to Ireland, or 82, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And he was well past his sell-by date. He had lost absolute fortunes or whatever. I think they call him the first Hollywood train wreck or whatever, because he had so many marriages, and then every penny that he made had been squandered by his members of his family and whatever. So he really shouldn't have been on the road, and he wasn't in a fit state to do a show, but he did it.
Okay, well, listen, Pat, we're coming towards the news. Backstage Pass, it's so good. So many great stories. It really is. It's all there. A Life in Show Business, Pat Egan it is, forward by Billy Connolly. Just one last thing. Did you put Led Zeppelin on in the stadium?
No,
wasn't you. Okay, at that time, you were selling tickets, and I remember you had to buy a Pink Floyd ticket and you get a T-Rex ticket, or the other way around or something.
Well, we probably only had a limited number of tickets. We would have got the tickets from Jamaican at the time or whatever.
All right, right. It wasn't specifically you.
No,
right, indeed. No. Okay. So, Pat, like, I mean, are you doing any of this stuff now still?
Well, I'm not doing that. And at the moment, I have about 30 or 40 shows on sale, but
But you have the whole, you have a memorabilia world, don't you?
Oh, yes, I have. I've been collecting stuff all my life, but I'm getting rid of it or giving it away or whatever now, because it's time to move on, you know.
Is it? All right. Well, listen, Pat, thank you very much indeed. It is a pleasure, and it's
thank
a great
you,
read.
Dave.
Backstage Pass, A Life in Showbiz. Pat Egan, if there's a Christmas stocking, stick it in.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.